Job chapter 2 is where we're going to be beginning tonight, so I invite you to turn your Bibles to the book of Job in chapter 2 as we talk about avoiding the sin of Job's friends. What do you say to someone who is hurting and who is suffering and is obviously in some pain? How do you give comfort to them? How do you be of a support to them? It's a big question to answer, and in no way am I going to answer that entire question tonight in the lesson. But what I would like to do is show you an example of what not to do. As we look at how Job's friends attempted to comfort him and to be there for him, we see that they failed miserably in that, and that it was not just a matter of saying insensitive things to Job about him and his family and what he was going through. They actually sinned in what they did. We'll talk about that toward the end of the lesson. But we need to think about very carefully how to not be like them in their example. Because the very last thing that we want to do when someone is hurting is to hurt them even more with words that we might think are helpful to them in their life but are actually really not that helpful at all. So let's read the very first thing we hear or we see about the friends in Job from chapter 2. After we have found out that Job has had his health attacked, has his family attacked, has his servants and his possessions attacked, everything about Job has been attacked by the time we get to the part where the friends are coming to him. And notice what they're trying to do. Okay, verse 11 of chapter 2. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, they came each from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. And they made an appointment together to come to show him sympathy and comfort him. But when they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him. And they raised their voices and wept, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. I think it's really interesting that we're explicitly told in the text that when they came, they had the intention of giving him sympathy and comfort, and they wanted to help him. It's not as if on the road to Job, they all got together and they said, when we get to him, we're going to say the meanest possible words we can think of. We are going to try our best to beat Job down into the dirt. That was not their attitude. I mean, keep in mind, these are friends of Job. Job being one of the most righteous men in the world at the time, the one that God pointed out to the devil and said, that's the guy you need to pay attention to. He keeps my will. So these are his friends. They probably had great character qualities and were good men in a lot of ways. But in this particular moment, when Job really needed his friends, they weren't really there for him. And in fact, in chapter 16, verse 2, we get later on into the book where they have been spouting their homespun wisdom. And Job looks at them in 16:2 and says, miserable comforters are you all. I wish you'd just leave me alone. So we're going to look at their example of what not to do and how to avoid the sins of his friends, of Job's friends. The first thing that we need to think about when we look at their example is that we need to not assume that the suffering of other people is tied directly to something that they have done wrong in their life. Because that's exactly what the friends assumed about Job. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, they speak multiple times, and just about every time they speak, they throw out this philosophy of wicked people do really badly in this life, and righteous people, they do really well. they're blessed by God and wicked people are condemned. And you know, generally speaking, wicked people do, because of their sins, that brings consequences on themselves and they go through suffering because of that. Righteous people generally have a pretty good life, but not in all cases. This is only a general truth. Wicked people sometimes are lifted up and are blessed in this life. And sometimes righteous people have a terrible time in their lives. But because Job's world has crumbled, his friends assume that he's done something very wrong. You go to chapter 4, and we read one of the first things that one of the head friends, I call Eliphaz the head friend because he's the one who speaks first, and he's the one that is directly talked to by God at the end. And so he seems to be the guy in charge of the friends. And so what Eliphaz says in chapter 4, verse 7, is he doesn't start out by accusing Job. He starts out by giving insinuations. He starts implying, Job, you know, this is the way the world works, and you fit this mold, so this means you need to think about your life. So he says, verse 7, starting, remember who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I've seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. By the breath of God they perish, and by the blast of his anger they are consumed. So you see how he's saying, you know, this is how the world works, Job, and you're not doing well in your life. And so, if you're perishing, it must mean that you're wicked. But then, evidently, later in the book, more serious things are said. You go to chapter 34, and in chapter 34, verses 7 and 8, we have Elihu, who is not talked about as a friend of Job, but is sort of a young man who is listening into all the conversations, and when everybody stops speaking, then he finally gives a speech. And he, in the first things of what he's saying, seems to be quoting what the friends have said and the kind of garbage that he's been listening to. And in verse 7 of chapter 34, Elihu says, "What man is like Job who drinks up scoffing like water, who travels in company with evildoers and walks with wicked men?" So this is just the way that the friends are looking at him, and further into the book, they just get more serious about their accusations. Well, he just walks with wicked guys. He just hangs out with people who don't care about God. Well, where are they getting that about Job? They haven't seen that, but that's how far they are committed to their philosophy that they're going to accuse him like that. You must have done something wrong. So they're going to fill in the gaps to make sense of what they are seeing. And when we go into the New Testament even, we see that the disciples of Jesus even had this same problem with their thinking, that if you're suffering, you must have done something wrong. Because in John chapter 9, we have the story of the man who is blind, who has been born blind. And remember in John 9, verse 2, the disciples ask Jesus, "Rabbi, who sinned? Who sinned? Who did something wrong in this situation, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" And Jesus has to correct that and say, "No, you're thinking about that all wrong. He's that way because the glory of God needs to be shown through him." And then the miracle happens. But here's what we need to think about. Are we tempted to look at other people who are going through a time of suffering and pain and assume that they haven't been living very well in their lives? When we see a brother or sister in our church going through a difficult time in their marriage, do we assume that, well, they're having a difficult time because they're reaping what they're sowing, and she must have a hard time respecting him because he must be a bum. He must be a kind of person who doesn't treat her very well in X, Y, and Z ways. Or he must not love her the way she should because she's probably a nag. She probably doesn't do the laundry like she should. She probably does these things against him. And so they're probably experiencing problems because, and we try to fill in the blanks in our minds when we don't know what's going on. We don't have the right to assume things about other people's characters. When we look at somebody who's not very wealthy and they don't enjoy the kinds of comforts and the blessings that we do, do we assume that they're poor and they're not very well off because they're not hard workers like we are? They're couch potatoes. This person probably doesn't even have a budget. They're probably really bad stewards of their money. They're probably addicted to drugs. They're probably in this financial situation because of some character flaws. And it's true that for some people, character issues do lead to poverty, but not necessarily. We can't just assume and fill in gaps when we don't understand their life situation. Because when we do that, doesn't it end up affecting the way we try to comfort them? When we see them in pain, we see them in sorrow, or we see them in some kind of hardship, the gaps that we fill in then come out of our mouth, and we might start saying things like the friend said to Job, and that would be something the effect of, if I were you, I would seek God. In other words, you're not doing that like you should, and I would seek God. That's what the friends say to Job. Or I would pray more. I would go to God and hand all this over, and then you're bound to have a better life because God takes care of righteous people. And they don't have as many problems. They have good marriages. They have stable lives. But when we do that, we're acting just like the friends of Job. Second lesson that we can learn from the friends is that when we try to comfort somebody, sometimes it's best not to say anything. Sometimes silence really is golden when it comes to comfort and sympathy. And that's exactly what the friends of Job did at first. We read in chapter 2, when they go to him, they are so shocked that they can't even recognize their friend, that they sit down with him in the dust and they don't say a word. Did you notice for how long? It wasn't just a couple of hours or a day. They don't say anything for a week. And that was the best thing that they ever did for Job in the scope of this book. They should have just not said anything. Because when they start opening their mouths to give out their wisdom and their great life experience and their knowledge of spiritual things, they mess it all up completely. And if you've ever studied the book of Job, you know that in no point in Job's speeches does he ever look back on this story in chapter 2 and say, you know that time you didn't say anything to me for a week? I wish you had said something. But what he does say later on is, I wish you would go back to being silent. Because you go to chapter 13 after they have been spouting for a while. And chapter 13, verse 5, Job says, oh, that you would keep silent, and it would be your wisdom. So please, go back to doing that again. But think about the application of us. When we see somebody in suffering, our gut reaction, what we first want to do is say something. And I'm sure that often it's out of good motives. We see somebody in pain, and the first thing that we can think of to try to help them out of their pain is to say something to try to comfort, to give advice, even when they haven't asked us for advice. And to tell them about our experiences, to give them our home remedies, to try to tell them as much as we can to try to help them ease their situation. But sometimes we cause more damage by speaking than we do by being silent. Sometimes somebody who's suffering doesn't want to hear a lecture. on what they need to do to bear their pain. Sometimes they just want your presence. And that's what Job wanted. Job was not looking for mouths. He was looking for ears. He was looking for somebody to be there, to know that they cared by their presence. And obviously, being silent, like we're talking about here, doesn't mean ignoring pain. It doesn't mean pretending that it's not going on and that that person is absolutely fine in their life. We do need to shower somebody with love and sympathy in a time of pain and loss, but maybe that doesn't come in the form of a lot of words. Maybe it comes in the form of a short phrase like, "I am so sorry," or "I love you," I care for you, "I am here for you." Maybe it just comes in the form of a hug, depending on what the person prefers. But we should not try to bombard a sufferer with our opinions about how their pain can go away. Sometimes their pain is not going to go away just by us saying things to them. Many of you know Scott Smelser, who preaches in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a friend of ours. And if you do know him, you probably know that he did lose his oldest son in an accident in Bowling Green. And when that happened, the Smelsers immediately drove down to Kentucky to deal with the situation, and they immediately drove back up, and Scott was preaching the very next Sunday back in Gettysburg. And I'll never forget some things he said in that sermon. And in that sermon, he said that when they went in that morning, some of the members met him and said, "You know, I really just don't know what to say to you." And in the lesson, Scott was telling that story and said, "You know what? If you don't know what to say, that's perfectly fine. Because nothing you can say is really going to help. That is going to bring Adam back." Sometimes we just need to be there for someone in silence. To not gush words, but to just be there. Job preferred silence from his friends, and I'm sure many people would be like Job in that respect. The third point that I think we need to learn from the friends of Job is that when somebody is in legitimate sorrow and pain, that should be validated, that should be given credence, that should be respected instead of dismissed. You think about Job's situation when the friends come to him in chapter 2. He has lost his camels, his sheep, his oxen, his donkeys, a lot of his servants. He's lost all 10 of his children on one day. He's lost his possessions. His wife has gone crazy on him. And she has told him to commit suicide. And he refrains from that. His body is racked with pain because of boils. And he's scraping his skin with pottery. He feels utterly alone, and he honestly believes that God is trying to shoot him down. Now, if you're a friend of a guy in this situation, don't you think that one of the first things to do is to validate the fact that he's in pain? But they don't do that. There's not one ounce of sympathy. You would think that you would go to somebody like this and say, "You know, Joe, I've never seen anybody have to suffer the kinds of things that you're suffering in your life. I am so sorry. I am here for you, whatever you need from me." Words fail me to describe how sorry I am that you would be hit this hard in your life. But instead, look at what they do say. Chapter 8 of Job. This is Bildad the Shuhite, who is speaking these words, and he says in chapter 8, beginning in verse 3, "Does God pervert justice? Does the Almighty pervert the right? If your children have sinned against him, he has delivered them into the hand of their transgression. If you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you're pure and upright, surely he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation. I want you to especially look at what he says in verse 4 about Job's kids. You know, I'm not normally a physically aggressive guy, but I think if Bildad said this to me, I might be provoked into a reaction that I would regret. Because you notice what he's saying to him. He's looking at the situation of Job's children dying and saying, you know what? Wicked people perish. Wicked people die like this. And so the reason why your kids are dead is probably because they're a bunch of reprobates. They're a bunch of sinners. Can you imagine saying this to Job? You know, if somebody is whining and complaining about minor inconveniences, we should not give credence to that. We should not confirm that their crankiness is okay. But when somebody is truly suffering like this and going through loss, we should not dismiss it. We should not excuse it. We should not try to make it all better. People go through grieving processes. I'm not sure if I've got this on the screen. Actually, I do. 2 Samuel chapter 1 is a passage where David has just heard about the death of his very close friend Jonathan and his enemy Saul. He understands that he is going to be the next king now, but he takes time to grieve. He takes time to go through a process where he tries to understand and to internalize and to process his grief. And so 2 Samuel 1, we won't go and read that passage, but he writes a psalm about his grief and he takes it to God. So grief is a natural thing to do. And when somebody is naturally grieving, then we shouldn't try to make that go away from them. We should understand that sometimes life makes people sad. That not all of us are going to be bouncing off the walls happy all the time. That day is coming, that day of joy when we will all feel perfect bliss is going to come, but that day is not now. Remember in John chapter 11, I have that on the screen too. John chapter 11, Jesus, right before he goes and resurrects his friend Lazarus from the dead, brings him back from Hades. You know, you recall that in that verse, he cries. He shows emotion. He grieves for the sin and the death that is caused by that situation. And so we should not encourage depression. We should not encourage somebody to go into a deep darkness stage of their life, but we need to be okay with the fact that sometimes people grieve. We need to be there for them as best we can. So how should we validate the suffering of others? Romans 12 in verse 15 gives us a really simple answer to that question. Romans 12, of course, is the section where Paul is getting very, very specific about some things that the Christians can do in their spiritual life. And in chapter 12, in verse 15, Paul says this very simply: rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. In other words, if somebody is really joyful, we need to find a way to outwardly express that joy to them. And if somebody is in sorrow, we need to find a way somehow to outwardly express our genuine sorrow to them. And sometimes that's going to come in the form of literal tears, weeping with those who are weeping, as it says right here. Sometimes that's going to come in a calm act of service, in a hug. in a few words of sympathy. But somehow we need to communicate to them, I understand that this is hard, but I love you and I care and I'm here for you, whatever you need. Okay, let's now answer the question that we talked about at the very beginning of this lesson. This lesson is ultimately about avoiding the sin of Job's friends. What was their sin? We talked a lot about what they did that was not good, that they shouldn't have done. But the thing, to me, that is most serious about what they did in this story is that they misrepresented God in what they said to Job. It wasn't just a matter of speaking insensitive things. If you go to chapter 13, and I want to read a few verses that Job says here in one of his speeches as he talks to them about what they're doing. He says, giving them a warning, "Will you speak falsely for God and speak deceitfully for Him? Will you so show partiality toward Him? Will you plead the case for God? Will it be well with you when He searches you out? Or can you deceive Him as one deceives a man? He will surely rebuke you if in secret you show partiality. Will not His majesty terrify you and the dread of Him fall upon you? Your maxims are proverbs of ashes. Your defenses are defenses of clay." You notice that if you read these words really carefully, Job isn't just telling his friends that what they're saying is worthless. He's also telling them, be on the lookout for God. God's going to search you. God's going to see whether what you're saying is really true about Him, because you're claiming to speak for Him. So you better watch out. And when we go to the very end of the book in chapter 42, we find out that God did search them. God did test them. And God was not happy with what He heard them saying. So let's go to chapter 42, the very end of the book. After Job has been confronted by God Himself, you know, Job has been calling on God the whole book. I need you to answer me. I want you to have a discussion with me. God finally does show up. Job is humbled. But Job's not the only one who's humbled. Because you go to chapter 42, verse 7. The Lord had spoken these words to Job. After the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, "My anger burns against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Now therefore take seven bulls and seven rams and go to my servant Job and offer up a burnt offering for yourselves, and my servant Job shall pray for you, and I will accept his prayer, not to deal with you according to your folly." And then, just in case they missed it, he says it again. "For you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has." So Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite went and did what the Lord had told them, and the Lord accepted Job's prayer. I think it's interesting that Job is the one who is the mediator in this situation. They have been aiming their arrows at this man, and God turns the situation around and says, okay, you go to him, and you ask him to mediate for you, because I'm going to accept his prayer. But I'm really mad at you guys for what you did and what you said about me. That was the main issue here. God didn't say, that thing you said about his kids, that was terrible to say something like that. Or what, you didn't give any comfort and sympathy for the fact that he lost all this and his health. And no, you spoke of me what is wrong. And that is the serious issue. When we comfort somebody, we had better be very careful that we don't claim what we are saying is spiritual wisdom from God when it's actually just our opinions about how the world works or about what they should do to get out of their suffering. Sometimes when somebody is suffering, I hear somebody say something like this: well, this happened for a reason. God is doing something here with your life. And ultimately, that might be the direct hand of God operating in this situation, but we just don't know how God's providence works. We know that He's active in the world, but we can't see how that happens very specifically. In Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 11, God says, "Time and chance happen to them all." Sometimes good and bad things happen because God is pulling the strings and pushing the buttons, but sometimes, because He's worked in chance into the fabric of His universe, sometimes bad things happen because God just allows them to happen. So if we tell somebody, "This is God working here, you know, and this is how it's happening, and you need to think about this in the right way," are we claiming to speak for God and misrepresent Him as the friends were? We need to be very careful that when we comfort, we only speak His words, not ours, and claim to represent Him when we are actually just representing ourselves and speaking on our own authority. God does not appreciate that. We are not being helpful to the one we're trying to comfort. Appreciate your words, your kind attention to these words of God tonight. I know this is a heavier subject, but it's a good time to talk about it when there is no situation that is imminently on the horizon that this lesson would address. It's good to talk about these things when the waters are calm rather than when the waters are choppy. And I appreciate your attention to these things. If you need to obey the gospel tonight, or you need to repent of the life that you've been living as a Christian and to come back to God, we would invite you to think about your life and to think about the gospel and to think about how you fit in relation to it. And if we can help you with your spiritual needs tonight, I'd ask you come forward now, so that we can help you as we stand and sing the invitation song.